Hello and welcome back to The Brunch Files, where we serve up bottomless brunch-worthy topics about life in your 30s. We're your hosts, Rachel and Tegan, and on the menu today, we have a very special guest. We have Chloe, the lady physio, back with us. You might remember a few episodes ago, we had an episode with Chloe talking all things pelvic floor health, and we're back again today, and we're talking everything pre and postnatal and birth. So welcome, Chloe.
Thank you so much for having me back. I'm super excited to be here with you in the studio.
In person this time, because last time we did it over the phone. So it's so nice to actually be sitting here in each other's presence. Yep. And really looking forward to digging into this. And we know not all our listeners, I mean myself included, I don't want kids. So if this one isn't for you, feel free to join us in the next one. But I think it's still also really interesting, important information for everyone to be aware of. So we thought, why not? Let's talk about it. Yeah. Do you want to tell us a bit about yourself though? And your business?
Yeah, I have a business called The Lady Physio in Warrnambool. So I do face-to-face pelvic floor physio there, and I'm just branching out into online. So I've got a online course that goes through birth preparation. So it's called Pelvic Floor Prep for Birth, and it basically goes through all of the things that you need to know for your pelvic floor before you give birth. So I'm really excited to be launching that and hopefully helping more and more women with this kind of stuff.
Yeah. Do you have a sort of tentative launch date for that yet?
So at the moment you can buy it, it's mm-hmm. out and ready, but I will be relaunching a live version. So at the moment it's remote and self-paced, but I'm looking at launching a live version and then breaking it up into smaller lessons so that people can do bits and pieces if they don't want to do the whole thing.
So when you say live version, do you mean people can kind of have a camera on in their living room and you instruct it live?
That's just cool.
Yeah, definitely. So I would just be presenting the course because it is a lot of content. It's about 6 hours of video lessons, but they're all broken up at the moment into 10 to 30 minutes. But if some people find that difficult to kind of self-motivate mm-hmm. and self-pace themselves, I will be bringing out a live version as well so that we can just do that sort of 6 hours straight with like a break mm-hmm. in the middle so that then people can kind of get all of the answers and questions as they go. At the moment, I've got a question and answer in the self-paced version, so you can jump on Zoom with me mm-hmm. and answer your questions that way. And we've got a Facebook group and everything as well for questions, but then that live version will just be slightly different. Yeah.
Mm, what a great resource. We'll have to share it once the live version's up and running, but we can share the current version now, I'm sure, after this episode goes live.
Yeah, totally. So definitely. I think this topic is something that too many people don't know about mm-hmm. in terms of the things you can be doing, I suppose, during your pregnancy to prepare yourself for birth and for that recovery. And I love you do fantastic content on social media, so your TikTok and your Instagram, educating people about their pelvic floor, about the things they can be doing. So what would be, I guess, where would you start with this? If someone was brand new and they're thinking, what do I need to know? Where do you begin when you're educating someone?
So I think pelvic floor education obviously starts with knowing what your pelvic floor is and what it mm. does, but we did go through that in the last episode. So if you want to go back and listen to that one, we probably won't go over it again in too much detail. Yeah. But that episode,
maybe a quick refresher yeah. just in terms of, I guess, yes. the anatomy.
Where is it?
Yeah. Yes, definitely.
Hopefully people know where it is, Rachel.
Hopefully, but you would be very surprised what people do and don't know that I see in the clinic. And a lot of people are super embarrassed and are like, oh my God, like, how do I not know this? And I'm like, literally no one has taught
We're
you
not
this.
Taught it.
No.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. So it's that sling-like structure that's underneath your pelvis that's holding all of your pelvic organs up. So where you wipe when you go to the toilet, underneath all of that skin is where those muscles are. So basically, I was actually at a course today and I was learning how to fit pessaries. So these are support devices mm-hmm. to help lift all the pelvic organs up. And the lady who was running the course is a New Zealand lady. She's hilarious. And so she was talking about a way to describe how to do pelvic floor exercises. And I always talk to people about like thinking about trying to hold in wind, but the way that she explained it was just gold. So she was like, you've just eaten a lot of baked beans and also like sauerkraut and all of these things. And then you've walked into a lift and then Chris Hemsworth has walked into the lift after you. And then you're trying to hold in that fart. It's so funny. That is,
you don't forget that. That
what
is
a great descriptor.
Just think of Chris Hemsworth in the lift.
Yes.
And all the broccoli and things in your tummy.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, anything that makes you fart, definitely. So that, you know, lift when you're holding in wind is using all of that pelvic floor, but the same sort of lift as when you're trying to stop the flow of urine and trapped holes.
Is it the same thing? Because that's how it was described to me. I think my mum, when I was young, sort of talked about that, like stopping the flow of urine. Is it essentially, I'm just trying to do it now. Like, is it essentially the same? It's just they're different ways of describing it. Like,
they are different ways of describing it, but they are different muscles as well. Mm. And they can be isolated. I've got like a tiny little model here that I might just put up because we'll put some of this on social media. So this is like a little model of the pelvic floor that we've got here. So this just shows the outside muscles and it also shows the inside muscles. So you've got the different muscles there that are helping to work around the different holes. So obviously you've got your vagina and then you've got your anus and then you've got those muscles on the front that are holding and then you've got the muscles on the inside that we can't see as well, which is pretty cool. So with that, you can see that you can actually, the different colors you can kind of isolate and do together. So you can do the front and focusing around stopping that flow of urine, and then you can do the back and stopping that wind from escaping. So those all work together and in conjunction, and you'll never isolate them completely, but depending on what function you want is where that muscle recruitment will focus.
Yeah, it's so interesting because I think people don't really think of it as a group of muscles and kind of like that's what's at the bottom of everything, sort of like your pelvis is open if you look at a skeleton and it's like so everything doesn't fall out, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Which is kind of wild.
It is really wild, and definitely there is that, you know, hole where the muscles are supporting, so there's no bone or anything under that holding everything up. So I guess in terms of where to start, I think pelvic floor exercises is where we start when we first get pregnant. But we were talking before about before you get pregnant,
so what if people are thinking, you know, in the next 6 to 12 months, it's something we're thinking about family planning, we think we might start trying to have a baby. Is there stuff people should start then?
Yeah. Like, so
what would you say in that prenatal
in period? You know, before you're pregnant, I think really important if you have symptoms to try and get those sorted out. So if you do have leaking or you do have any issues with pain with sex or any issues with, you know, being able to hold in wind or all of those things.
Like urgency? Like if you find that once you need to go to the toilet, you really have to go?
Yes, definitely. Yeah. If you have to go quickly for your bladder or your bowels, all of those things can be a sign of pelvic floor dysfunction. So definitely good to sort them out before you get pregnant, because once you get pregnant, pretty much as soon as you get pregnant, you start to get those hormonal changes that increase the laxity of your ligaments. And so that means that everything becomes a bit more flexible in preparation for birth. And those hormones do peak quite early. So they peak at, you know, 12 to 14 weeks. And so if you have already have leaking or you already have issues, then it's just going to be exacerbated pretty quickly with pregnancy.
That's so interesting. So I think a lot of people think about it when you're like heavily pregnant or like postpartum. I think a lot of people would think they'd have issues that early.
Yeah, definitely. And the thing with that as well is that a lot of people notice when they first get pregnant, they're running to the toilet a lot. So they have that frequency. They need to go a lot of the time in the first trimester, settles down in the second trimester because those hormones settle down, and then it peaks again in that third trimester because of the weight and the heaviness. So it's kind of goes up and down. So you might think, oh yeah, actually I was bad at the start, but now I'm fine. That is just a sign of that, you know, laxity that was happening at the start that then will continue to get worse over the pregnancy. And then even when you're early postpartum, and a lot of the time if you're breastfeeding, that those hormones really perpetuate that flexibility, so you're still more flexible for up to 6 to 12 months after you give birth.
How lucky we are as women.
I know. And I think about this in the context of other exercise, like normal exercise. So we learned a lot about this in my course. And you think about your body with this kind of thing and different moves that you're doing and care you might take. But I didn't really think about it in terms of pelvic floor muscles.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's a big thing, especially with like gyms and screening and that kind of thing that I see a lot, is I treat a lot of women that are highly active because I put a lot of stuff on my Instagram about it. So I treat a lot of women who do CrossFit and who do running and who do heavy, high impact exercise. And a lot of the time they might not have been screened for that before they started that exercise, which is standard. There's not that many places that will do a pelvic floor questionnaire or even ask, do you have any issues with your pelvic floor? And then they'll come to me and be like, oh, but I was fine and I had a postnatal check and I was completely fine and now they have prolapse. So it's one of those things that is super important.
That's an awesome, like, important thing for me to think about too with clients, because I hadn't thought to sort of ask that question. Yes, some clients talk to me about it, they'll bring it up, but not everyone is comfortable bringing it up or thinks to bring it up. So
we spoke about that, I think, in our first episode as well. It can be like a bit of a sort, because it feels very private and intimate, and it can be a bit of a source of embarrassment, especially if you are having issues with like bladder leakage and things like that. It's not necessarily a comfortable topic to disclose to just a random macho trainer at the gym.
Definitely.
So you just break it out of CrossFit.
Yeah, and I think privacy and consent is obviously super important with that. So if you're doing your, you know, initial thing, it needs to be somewhere private so that they can disclose to you, and it also needs to be with consent. So, you know, I'm just going to ask this question about your pelvic floor. If you don't want to answer, that's fine, but it's just to make sure that we're doing everything we can to support you and make sure that you don't have any injuries, like that kind of thing.
What a lovely way to approach it.
Yeah.
So then I guess if you're thinking about trying to conceive, go see a pelvic physio. That'd be your first step, just to make sure everything's good. Or is that really only if you've had issues? Like, otherwise it's fine? Or?
I think if you have symptoms, definitely. If you haven't had any symptoms, then you don't need to worry about it as much. I'd probably just go after the end of your first trimester. So once you're past that 12-week mark, then that's usually in that second trimester when we would do it.
Yeah. And then you've conceived. First trimester, what are you thinking about? What are some things? Are there things that is best practice or that are best practice for everyone to start thinking about and doing?
Yeah, definitely. So pelvic floor exercises, you can start straight away, and it is recommended in the international guidelines to do, you know, 3 sets a day of pelvic floor exercises regardless of how pregnant you are. But it doesn't matter if you don't start as soon as you get pregnant. Mm-hmm. Any time that you start is going to be beneficial. A lot of the research supports even and from 35 weeks, if you're even only doing them from 35 to 40, that you're still going to reduce your risk of injury.
Amazing.
So
never too late.
Well, no.
And when you talk about injury, do you mean specifically just prolapse, or are there other things that we should be?
We're talking about
now. We're jumping ahead, but
yes, definitely pelvic floor dysfunction as a whole. So if you have pelvic floor dysfunction, it's all of those symptoms basically, and it's not just prolapse. It is leaking, you know, bladder, bowels, all that kind of stuff. It's urgency, it's pain with sex, it's all of those things. So it's basically to prevent any kind of symptoms developing in the pelvic floor area.
And is it, I feel like it's just assumed that you have a baby, that stuff happens. Like, we don't get taught that, you know, you can avoid it. I mean, you can't avoid everything, like you said. Sometimes things will happen, but that you can actively be doing stuff to prevent that, which is just really powerful for women to know that.
Definitely. And I think the issue here is that pelvic floor physio and pelvic floor research is really new. So part of the issue is that it takes about 10 years for research to get into commonplace clinical practice, and that's because clinicians don't have time to look at the research. Oh, well, a lot of people don't, and a lot of people don't have an interest in it. It's really boring, but I'm a massive nerd, so
love it.
I'm obsessed. So then basically, you know, 10 years ago we didn't have the evidence that we have today. 20 years ago we definitely didn't have any really strong evidence to support what we do. And the strong evidence that we have for pregnancy and birth is only coming out in the last sort of 3 or 4 years. So it's one of those things that basically is, you know, cutting edge science now.
Yeah. I also think it sometimes is a bit normalized as well, that like you might have that, like, I think always think to that Lights by Tenor ad, when it's like a little laugh, a little cough kind of
LBL.
Thing. Like, just wear your, like, you know,
your liner,
just,
or whatever.
Just wear a liner. Like, that's kind of it. It's like no other.
Yes.
You know, it's like,
and that's
just
marketing.
Yes.
It's funnest. But also, potentially there wasn't a whole heap that you could do other than have surgery in the past.
Yeah.
And so I think now that we do have all these rehabilitation options and we do have so many prevention options, that people would have just had to put up with it, I think, previously, really, unless they wanted to go and have surgery.
Yeah. So 3 sets a day, great place to begin.
Yes.
As you perhaps enter second trimester, like, are there other considerations? Are there more breathing things? Are there other things you suggest?
Yeah, definitely. So obviously with those 3 sets a day, you want to be doing, you know, strengthening the pelvic floor in different ways to prevent different things. So
actually, let's talk about three sets. What does that look like? What are we doing?
Yes. So if you want to recap on this, I do have a free guide on my website. So that's something to go and download. But basically we want to be squeezing the pelvic floor quickly to help prevent leaking when we cough, sneeze, laugh, when pressure comes down. So that's
like little
that.
Squeezes?
Yeah, quick on and off. But with that, we just have to be careful and important that you remember to relax all the way down, because sometimes we tend to go up to the top of the elevator and then we only go down halfway and then we come up and down just to get that speed. It's not actually about the speed. It's about going through that full range, because if we're halfway already or we're at the top already and then pressure comes down, then we actually can't stop that pressure because we have nowhere to go.
So you're sort of thinking squeezing all the way up as much as you possibly can, releasing out and
so like squeeze slowly, release. Sorry, squeeze quickly as you can. Slowly.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And then wait till you're fully down at the bottom of the elevator. I like that analogy. It's like a nice visual.
Yes.
Before you then squeeze quickly again.
Exactly.
And definitely. How many? Like 10? Like
yeah, 10's good for that. But some people won't be able to do 10 when they mm-hmm. first start because it's just too tiring and too fatiguing and mm-hmm. you won't be able to get to the top of the elevator. By the fifth one, you're only getting to level 5.
And is it best to only do as many as you can do well and fully?
Yes.
Like in, you know, if you're lifting weights essentially. Exactly. Like it's
yeah, it's proper, the same proper principle. Yep. Yeah, definitely. You're better off to go for quantity over quality. Quality over quantity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And is there, I've heard some people talk about the squeezing up and holding mm-hmm. at the top.
Yes.
Is that a thing you recommend as well?
Yes, definitely. So it's good that these things kind of come in threes. Do yep. 3 sets and there's 3 types of exercise as yep. well. So there's that on and off, the coordination I call it, and then there's the stronghold, so as hard as you can. And basically you want to be going to 100% or the top of the elevator and holding that for as long as you can. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's really hard to tell how long you can hold that for, and sometimes you might just start to like peter off towards yeah. the end of the contraction and then there's not much let go at the end. And so you might need to find where that middle ground is with it. So where you can actually get that quality and be at the top and then get that good relax. Mm-hmm. Because if you're just petering out, then you're teaching your pelvic floor that it can turn off without your control.
Okay. And what's the third one?
And the third one is an endurance hold. So halfway, and you basically want to hold around about half. So like level 5, if there's 10 levels, and then hold that for as long as you can. And a lot of people are super surprised with the endurance hold. Most people, when they first start, can only do like 5 or 10 seconds, mm-hmm. some people 15 seconds. And then you actually need to be holding for 1 minute if you want to run or you want to do.
1 minute?
Yeah. Wow. If you want to do heavy impact
exercise. I've never tried to hold for that long. I'm just more like, oh, I'll think about it every now and then, do a few holds and then off I go. Like,
yes.
Wow.
And so that's the return to running guidelines postpartum recommend that. But even during pregnancy, I recommend that as well because you're at risk during pregnancy because of the flexibility and the weight as mm-hmm. well.
And then breathing through that, does it matter what your breath is doing while you're doing that?
Some people do find it really difficult to do it without holding their breath. So that's where I usually at first just encourage normal breathing. And if you mm-hmm. can do it with normal breathing, great, because then you need to be able to hold your pelvic floor when you're breathing, when you're doing all sorts of different things. And so if you can only link it to your breath, then you're limited in when and how you can mm-hmm. use your pelvic floor. Mm-hmm. But then for some people, they can't do it without doing some kind of breathing exercise. So that's where I'll start with the breathing with them. So similar to when we go to the gym and we lift. So I'll start with getting them to do a breath in, and then on the breath out, on the effort, you hold your pelvic floor. Same as at the gym. On the effort, you're holding that breath out to help support.
Yeah. I suppose it could be quite challenging for some people, especially if you are trying to, because there's no visual, mm-hmm. right? Whereas most other muscle groups yes. or things that you're working, like if you're doing a bicep
can watch a demo.
You can see if it starts to fall, like, even mm-hmm. if you're, mm-hmm. you know, that sense. So I suppose that like mind-muscle connection, which can be really challenging for some people to sort of,
yeah, definitely
feel that sensation and like, I guess, focus on that as
no,
well.
If you're doing it right, or if, like you said, if it's petering yeah. off, you can't, there's no visual, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
I suppose that's where the elevator thing yes. kind of helps.
Yes, yeah. definitely. And I think it is really difficult to do it yourself without having some kind of advice or assessment. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, a lot of people can, but they're not sure. So then they don't. And then it's like, well, yeah. that's not super helpful. But if you are sure, like even another way to check is like if you squeeze around your partner during sex and they can feel the squeeze and the mm-hmm. tightening, probably doing it right. If you can stop your flow, definitely doing it right, like mm-hmm. if you're going to the toilet. So I think there's a couple of checks you can do there. The other thing, you could insert a finger and check that way mm-hmm. yourself as well to see. But I think the only thing is some people actually bear down or strain instead of contracting, and that can feel like you're actually squeezing because that actually comes down onto your finger. Mm-hmm. So then again, it's tricky.
Yeah. Can you tell the difference? Like if you're doing an internal examination, you can tell the difference between if they're bearing down or if they're like, so that's a good way if someone was to see you mm-hmm. that would help them differentiate if they're doing it right or not.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it's really easy for us to assess because we do it all the time.
Yeah,
but it's really hard for the average person
to self-assess.
Yes, yeah. exactly.
Anything else second trimester you'd want to touch on or start to recommend people in start integrating?
Yeah, so in second trimester, obviously things are starting to get heavier and often muscles are starting to get tighter in terms of just feeling like everything is restricted. There's less range of movement over time because your muscles usually compensate for the ligaments. So as the ligaments become looser, the muscles try to become firmer to hold everything in. So then if you've got muscle tightness or muscle imbalance, then you're going to actually get an issues where you're starting to get pain, and it can even affect the baby's position as you get further along. So starting some stretching can be really helpful in terms of that, in, you know, getting that baby in a good position and making sure that you don't get pelvic girdle pain or other issues.
And so what are the sorts of stretches you would recommend, like child's pose or like lunges or that sort of thing? Or
Definitely pelvic opening stretches are usually the ones that we give, but stretches all around the pelvis, like your hip flexors, your glutes, all of those muscles are going to be really important. Mm-hmm. And definitely something that we go over in lots of detail in my course. So I've got a whole stretch guide with, you know, 15 stretches that you can go through during pregnancy and even use in your labor as well.
Yeah. And in terms of frequency of stretching, what would be the recommendation? 2-3 times a week?
Yeah, it depends on how much stretching you're doing. So I think 2-3 times a week is good if you're going to do a decent session of like 15-20 minutes or even half an hour. But if you're just going to do a shorter amount, then I'd say most days. So if you're only going to stretch for like 5 or 10 minutes, then do it most days of the week.
While you're watching TV in an evening or something, just do a few. And
yes, exactly.
Yeah, start building the habit.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, totally. Anything else?
And I think obviously at that stage you're starting to think about your birth preferences and all of that kind of stuff. So that's really important, you know, where you're going to give birth, who's going to look after you. You probably started thinking about that a little bit earlier, but some people haven't. But all of that kind of stuff is really important to start thinking about because it makes a really big impact on your delivery and what happens in your birth. Mm-hmm.
And then third trimester, getting towards crunch time, keeping up these same things. So stretching the 3 times a day, your pelvic floor exercises.
Yeah.
Hopefully by then you've got a bit of an idea about your birth plan and that kind of thing.
Yes.
What else in the third trimester?
Yeah. So then it's really about making sure that you're going to get your baby into a good position to birth and go into labor naturally, hopefully, so that you can avoid inductions. A lot of people, you know, there's a lot of talk about induction and how common that is now.
So common. I can't, like, the amount of friends that have had that. It's very normalized, as in people are like, oh, you know, it's just part of. But, like, I would love actually to talk a little bit about birth and people's choices around birth, because the amount of friends that I have that have had a very unempowering birth where they feel like they were kind of beholden to, I guess it was very medical, and in some instances that was required. Others, they were like, I just didn't feel like I had a, could have a say, didn't really know where I stood. Mm-hmm. So I'd love to hear your take on that as well. Sorry, I'm jumping all over the place here, but I find it so interesting.
Yeah, definitely. And I think there is more and more talk about the medicalization of birth now, but I think there is just, like, the human race wouldn't exist if we needed so much medical intervention into birth. And I think the issue there is that people are saying that people are older when they're getting pregnant, true. Mm-hmm. People have more health conditions when they're getting pregnant, true. But also I think that our lifestyles are completely different now. So the pelvis isn't in normal anatomical positions ever. It's never.
We're sitting all the time.
We're sitting a lot more.
I didn't think about that. We don't squat as much.
Yeah. Exactly. So you never spend time in that deep squat position where you would have usually gone to the toilet. And, you know, you never spend that time putting stretch on your pelvic floor muscles. And so that's where, again, those stretches are going to be really important to bring on labor naturally. And I think the other thing is, you know, we're not anywhere near as active as we used to be. And so all of that walking that we used to do is going to be just then like getting baby to press down onto the cervix and get labor to start naturally. You know, we were used to it then, but we're not now. And then a lot of people are limited in how much they can do by pelvic girdle pain. Like you can't walk as much because you have pain, because you're sitting all day in your desk job.
I think we went through a period of time, maybe like 30, 40 years ago, maybe a bit before, where it was kind of like wrap pregnant women up in cotton wool, rest, take a
load
off,
down.
Don't lift anything heavy, don't do things. So I think we kind of...
There's like a hangover of that, I feel, where then people are then afraid to...
I wonder if it's come from, you know, back, like we go back like 150 years and 200 years, whatever, there was so much more... Like I always think how terrifying it must have been to be pregnant back then, because everyone would know someone who probably had died mm-hmm. in childbirth. And so it's wonderful mm-hmm. that we have these interventions mm-hmm. now that have reduced like maternal and child yeah. mortality rates. But it's Absolutely. Almost like the pendulum might be swinging too far mm-hmm. the other mm-hmm. way, because mm-hmm. we kind of have gone, oh, well, we've got to wrap everyone up in cotton yeah. wool. And now it's like, well, actually the evidence is challenging it. And then the inductions and mm. cesarean sectioning like frequency is increasing and all of that sort of stuff. And it's like, yeah, it's interesting how it's just kind yeah. of.
I always think about Sybil in Downton Abbey and like the preeclampsia mm. and stuff.
That's
like
a horrible story.
Oh, it is. It just made me think of that when you're like how scary it would have been to be pregnant and how, I mean, how much we know now and, you know, knowledge is power. And I suppose that's why I love the work you do, because I'm like, people can listen and learn and do your course and then feel empowered to make their own decisions and make a plan around birth and know what is necessary mm-hmm. medically and what they can actually make a choice about.
Definitely. And I think part of my course is actually assessing your risk during pregnancy. Mm. And I think that's really important because it's completely glazed over. So medical professionals will often tell you the average risk of mm-hmm. such and such. But if that doesn't apply to you, if you're not in the same age group, you're not the same ethnicity, you're not the same in terms of how many babies you've had, all of this kind of stuff. And then you're telling someone the risk of a severe pelvic floor injury is 3% when that's like wildly inaccurate for
not
that person.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
for that person, their risk might be 15%. It might be 20. It might be 30. Yeah. Like,
it's a danger of averages, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so then they're going in there thinking, great, low risk, 3%, no worries. And then they go and have all of these issues. Mm. And then they're like, why did it happen to me? Why did nobody tell me this? Like, yeah, when yeah. they're not. At yeah. all. And most of the time, if we had put in prevention strategies and beforehand, then we could reduce that risk to the average risk. Mm-hmm. So
does it happen in the other way as well, where risk can be overestimated? So say they're like, oh, we suggest you book in for a cesarean or induction or whatever based on an mm-hmm. average risk. So like,
yes.
Yeah.
Definitely. So again, that induction research was based on a big clinical trial in the US, which actually wasn't robust in terms of how it was done, mainly because no one wanted to agree to be in the trial. They didn't want to be told that they had to have an induction mm. or that they had to try for natural labor, which, you know, is almost unethical, I think, for people to be put in that position when they don't understand. Like, obviously, if there was significant medical need, they could change groups. Mm. But, you know, if there wasn't any significant medical need, then you're assigned to a certain group. Like, who would agree to that?
You'd be off, you're no one. It's quite so challenging for to do research on pregnant women.
Yes.
It's even, I think about this with alcohol, for example, mm-hmm. like a lot of areas that you look up, it's like they just say obviously have none mm-hmm. because we don't know where that, like probably a little is probably okay, but we don't know where the line is and we'll never do the research to figure it out because how can you do that ethically mm-hmm. in a way that you might injure some babies just to figure out if someone can have a glass of wine during their pregnancy. Mm-hmm. And so we just say no, because we don't know where the line is. But that's a pretty easy thing to remove. But you think about some of these other things that it would be really great to know, but it's like, how do you approach that ethically from a mm-hmm. medical standpoint? Mm. For research, I suppose you have to do, what is it, like population studies or retrospective?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, analysis. And there has been a really big retrospective analysis in Australia, which obviously has limitations as well. But there is a lot of good evidence there that supports the fact that we don't need anywhere near as many inductions mm. that we have. So I think, you know, more and more we are challenging that trial and I guess getting more evidence to the contrary, and you know, other countries are doing things differently than we are in Australia.
I thought it was really interesting. You told us before we started recording that in France you get, is it 20 mm-hmm. government funded appointments with a pelvic physio mm-hmm. during and after birth?
Yes. So most people will have say 10 before and 10 after, or they might have 5 during mm-hmm. and you know 15 after or whatever.
And in Australia some people don't even know that about, you know, that pelvic physios exist and can help them mm-hmm. pre and post birth.
Yeah. And they have so much lower risks, rates of prolapse, incontinence, all of those kinds mm-hmm. of things. And they also have a lot of countries actually don't use forceps anymore. And forceps is a massive injury risk for the pelvic floor. Mm. So if you have a forceps delivery, you have a 50% chance of having significant pelvic floor injury.
Wow. And we still use them.
Yeah, and we still use them in Australia quite commonly. In the course today, I heard the lady was talking about, she went to Perth and they were talking about some regional communities up in Western Australia, and they said for First Nations women, 80% of them were having forceps deliveries. Really? Like, that is just mad.
Why is that, I wonder?
I don't know. And I think a lot of it is, yeah, it's really hard to say. I think it's hard to look at it, but why? Maybe ease of use. Yeah. I don't know.
That's awful. Quickly, just back to pregnancy, you mentioned pelvic girdle pain. That and other issues, is that something you can assist or pelvic physios can assist with during pregnancy?
What are examples of pelvic girdle pain for people who may not know?
Yeah, so pelvic girdle pain is pain anywhere in your pelvis area, basically. So it can be at the front of the pelvis in that joint right in the middle that sort of like sits on your pubic mound. So that like mound bit that's kind of above your clitoris, that's kind of where you get a lot of that pelvic pain. And then you can also get it in the two joints on the back of your pelvis. So they're sort of either side, like smack bang in the middle of both of your glutes. And so you can get pain there. You can also get pain on the sides of the hips. You can get lower back pain. So all of those things can be pelvic girdle pain, but most of the time it's aggravated by doing lots. So being on your feet more, walking, standing on one leg, getting in and out of the car, rolling over in bed. So many different things can cause it to be aggravated, and definitely something that we can help manage. So a lot of the time we might need to give you some more support, like a compression or a belt to help hold everything in so your muscles aren't doing all the work, but then also strengthen the muscles to prevent it from getting worse.
Yeah, so wow. Interesting. Yeah. And so we spoke a little bit about first and second trimester, so stretching, what do we say? Stretching, and it was and also three times a day. I was trying to like phrase that in my mind anyway. And so obviously carrying those through, thinking about your birth preferences, but is there anything else people should be adding that
like getting closer to the day?
Yeah.
Yeah. So one of the biggest things that's really well supported in research now is perineal massage. So a lot of people have heard of perineal massage.
Yes. And tell us about that.
It's a word that people are like, what do you mean by that? So perineum is that skin between the vagina and anus. And so
is that the part that tears during
yes.
or they cut during an episiotomy essentially?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And so you can actually significantly reduce your episiotomy risk by doing perineal massage. Mm. So you can reduce that risk by 64%.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's significant.
It is. It's not like it's just like 3% reduction, you
it's
know.
It's like worth everyone doing.
Exactly. But I think there is a lot of things that put people off from doing it. It's a bit of a squeamish area. Mm. And also people don't know how to do it and when to do it and all of those kinds of things. So definitely something that you can see a physio about. But it's something that if you're high risk, you should be thinking about from sort of 32 to 34 weeks. So that's where that appointment earlier on will kind of help us to identify if you are high risk for whatever reason.
And how would someone know if they're high risk from like what are the sorts of markers, I suppose?
Yeah, so I have a bit of a series on my TikTok that you can probably go back to, but high risk things are being of like Asian ethnicity, so that's a really high risk, and being older, so the first time that you give birth if you're over 30 or over 35, really high risk. Being shorter, so if you're less than 155 centimeters is a high risk, and gaining a lot more weight during your pregnancy increases your risk as well. And that's just because of the risk of having a bigger baby. But in terms of that, everyone talks about big babies and the scans and how inaccurate they are. A lot of people are talking about that in my world, probably maybe not in like the average person's world. But I think when you're pregnant, you definitely hear those I guess the talk of that, and the scans can be, you know, up to 20% inaccuracy.
In terms of the size of your baby.
Exactly.
It's wild.
Yeah. So they can say that you're going to have a 4 kilo baby and it could come out like 3.6. So
And some people are induced on that basis as
well. Yeah, true. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so what I usually use to gauge is how much weight you've gained during pregnancy, because that's a certainty. We know how much weight you've gained, and that does correlate to how big your baby's going to be. So that's what I use, just because the scans are more inaccurate.
So interesting. Learning so much.
And so with the perineal massage, so you said it reduces your episiotomy risk by 64%, but what about tearing naturally?
Yes. Yeah, so
is that reduced as well?
Yeah, it'll reduce your risk of severe tears. So it'll reduce your risk of those third and fourth degree tears. And it will also reduce your risk of first degree tears, but the issue here is that with second degree, there will be very slightly more second degree tears, but that's because those ones that were going to be a third or fourth are converted to a second, okay. If that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah, that does. Yeah, yeah. I suppose some degree of tearing for the most part would be inevitable. I would have thought.
Is it inevitable?
It's not inevitable, but it is really common. So 80% of people will have some level of tearing.
Yeah. These are the heebie-jeebies. Yeah. Can you talk us through just really quickly, mm-hmm. how and what is it and how often?
Yeah, definitely.
I know you've got the content and people should see a pelvic physio, but are you happy to share a little bit about?
So with the perineal massage, it should be something that you are doing at least twice a week as a minimum, and it should be something that will be done from 32 to 34 if you're high risk. If you're low risk, it's like 35, 36. So you don't have to start it as early. And the more that you do.
Is there any benefit for starting it earlier? Like, or is there a point of like diminishing? Yeah. You know how sometimes it's like more is not always better.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So if you are high risk, the research isn't certain on that, but there appeared to be no difference on averages if you started it from 32 or from 35. So now the recommendation is 35.
Actually, I have a friend who she just roped her husband in to do it for him. She's like, it's time for my perineal massage.
Exactly. Yes.
Most husbands would be obliging.
Surely. Definitely, surely. And I think the big
something they can do.
Definitely. I think the only like thing that people have is they're a bit squeamish or funny about it. They don't want their partner to do it. But the vast majority of people would get so much more out of it if their partner did it. And a lot of people get their partner to come to the appointment, and then when we go through, they can learn how to do it. And if their partner can't come to the appointment, which is often the case, then I will practice it on the person so that then they know what it feels like. So then when their partner's doing it, they can be like, oh no, that's not right. Yeah.
Do you use oil or anything?
Yes, you do. So you can use a water-based lubricant. A lot of people use an oil. You can use like coconut oil or almond oil. Some people even just use olive oil, but there is some specific perineal massage oils as well that have like essential oils and things that are designed to help stretch the pelvic floor a bit more. They have no evidence, but they are nice and they smell nice.
And they're not dangerous.
Like no, exactly. Yeah, okay. Yeah, they're safe, but they don't have any evidence for their extra effectiveness.
Mm. Yeah. Anything else besides the massage and the other things we've touched on?
Yeah, and I think the last thing would be, you know, your birth positions and how you're going to push and all of that kind of stuff. So thinking about what positions are going to reduce your risk of tearing and what positions you'll be able to get into, changing your positions, and then also thinking about how well you can push.
Mm-hmm.
No, you go.
I was thinking, I know a lot of like friends who are pregnant at the moment who are going, like their hospital does like birthing classes that can go along. Does that topic get covered much, or is there like special, like should people seek out a birthing class run by a pelvic physio?
There is real massive variability in those birthing classes. So some of them have physio involvement, some of them don't. The one that my hospital has physio involvement. So it's going to be a little bit more evidence-based in terms of that physio perspective. Some of it just has midwife involvement, but that's not to say that it's bad. They might have the research and have all the resources as well. So it's really, you're just going to have potluck of what you get at that class. And I think if you want to seek out more information, a lot of the time it's just a really quick overview. So they go over and they say, these are your position options. And then they might say, these ones are probably what we see the most. These ones are what we recommend. But what that recommendation is based on, again, we don't know. So in my course, all the recommendations are based on research and the biggest systematic reviews in terms of, you know, looking at Cochrane, which is the biggest systematic review thing, and that shows you like literally all the studies that have been done, and it summarizes them and gives you like a plain language summary that people can understand and all of that.
Because you know, like every single movie ever and everyone's experience or understanding or what they picture with giving birth is a woman lying on her back in a hospital bed, which I've heard is like the worst position you can be in. Is this correct? Like, I mean, for some people, I know I've got one friend who said she's delivered both her babies on her back and she was fine.
Exactly.
But I remember.
And I suppose if you have an epidural, for a lot of people, that's your only option. Because you can't get up and move around.
Yeah, but that often isn't your only option, and people don't know that. So a lot of the time with an epidural, you can use them in different ways. So a lot of the time, time the epidurals are more mobile now, so that you will have some movement. They're not a complete block, and that makes them a lot safer, which is great. And then also you can birth on your side with an epidural, and you can often sometimes get the epidural to start to wear off by the time that you're pushing, so that then you could get into an upright position, because most of the time you need that epidural in that, you know, end of labor transition phase when the pain's really intense.
Isn't that when your cervix thins or something? I don't know. I've heard friends talk about that. And some people who've had no epidurals and then get to that point and they're like, I want one. And the nurse is like, sorry, you've missed the boat.
Yes.
It's too late.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
I remember a friend, I caught up with him, and him and his wife were like imminently giving birth, and they went to a really fantastic like 1 or 2 day birthing course, and it must have been, I assume it had physio involvement, and they had gone through all different positions and ways that he could support, like be behind her, arms underneath, all that kind of stuff. And he was telling us, in his mind you lie on your back to give birth, and he was like, did you know that, like, that's not, then he was telling us, you can be on all fours, you can do this, like, he just learned so much. And for him, you could tell it was really empowering, that he felt like he had a role then on the day, and ways he could, things he could do, ways he could support her. And I just think that was, that's amazing and beautiful.
I love that. Like
back in the day when men weren't even allowed in the room.
Yes. I know. Crazy, isn't it? And I was actually watching Bump. Have you guys ever watched that show on Stan?
No, I've seen it pop up. But yes. Worth it?
Good? It's really good. I really like it. But in maybe, I don't know, the third or second season, I was catching up on it earlier in the year when I had my hip surgery, and they had a birth scene in it, and it was just like the epitome of traumatic birth in my mind. Ugh. And I was just like, I can't. Cannot deal with this. They've literally.
Did you write them a letter?
I should have.
They presented as a traumatic experience or as like a normal experience?
I think afterwards they did, but at the time you couldn't tell that it was if you didn't know. Right. So afterwards they were like, oh my gosh, the trauma, blah, blah. But while as you're watching it, you might think that this is normal. Like, they didn't consent her for anything. And also I think that you can't give consent when you're in labor. Like, essentially you're under duress. Like, I think you are. And how can you consent to something when you have had pain relief and your actual conscious state changes during labor and birth? You, like, literally most people will have some kind of out of body experience in that your conscious state changes to deal with the pain. How can you consent to something when you are not cognitively normal? Like,
you're also probably like in a, like, if you're being asked for something, there's that heightened element of fear. Like, you're not thinking.
And a power and control relationship.
And you're like, well, if the doctor's telling me to do this, then I'll do it, because Why would they recommend that at this
point?
It's
a doctor.
If it wasn't valid,
Exactly, yeah. And I think the issue there is that, you know, people, medical professionals don't want to scare women, which I hate that. I'm just like, people want to know these things.
Tell us the truth.
Literally everyone.
No, I can decide.
Like, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Everyone that I've had in clinic is like, nobody told me this. I just wish I knew. And I hear, I just wish I knew. Like, if I had a dollar for how many times I heard that, it's just like, ugh. Anyway, and then you get the, obviously, the New South Wales Royal Commission, which highlights all of these things into birth trauma and highlights the lack of informed consent and all of those kinds of things. And thank God they now have a consent manual. So for vaginal birth, a lot of hospitals are now using a manual where you actually have to sign and agree to all of the different levels of vaginal birth. Yeah.
And is that part of your birth plan then? When you talk about having a birth plan, is that why it pays to think through every scenario and what your position on those things are before you're in that altered state of consciousness and in pain and on pain relief?
Exactly. And I think a lot of birth plans or birth preferences just go like all of the preferences that you prefer, like dim lights and what music you want and all of the fluffy stuff. And there's so much fluff out there. But if you follow me, you'll realize that there's not a lot of fluff on my page. And it's really about like facts and decisions.
And like the actual big decisions on the day, not what tune you want when the baby comes out.
Exactly.
Yeah. Which is, I mean, that's
managed.
Nice too,
but. How is that managed then? So if you kind of consent to all of these things beforehand, then we also know things don't always go to plan.
Exactly.
And so therefore you do need medical professionals to have agency to be able to intervene when it's needed, if your life or, you know, all that sort of stuff become at risk.
Yeah, definitely. So they have that agency if you are in a situation where there is medical risk to yourself or your baby, that they can obviously override those preferences. But that is also explained in that consent manual. So that's where people know that if there is a life-threatening situation, then that will be overridden, which I think most people would be completely fine with. And like, I'd be fine with that.
It's a prompt for the medical professional to think, actually, is this really necessary before, rather than just kind of going on default. default.
Which, yeah, it's like, this yes. is not her preference. Do I actually want to make this decision?
Yeah,
like,
do I need to do this? And then they right. have to like interrogate their own decision before.
Mm-hmm. Because, you know, at the end of the day, like, medical professionals do accept a lot of risk in these situations. And obviously obstetricians are risk averse for a reason, because they don't want bad things to happen, and that's totally fine.
And you don't want that as the patient either.
No, like, yes.
It's not about that.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's really balancing that risk, isn't it? And, you know, thinking about, for example, as a scenario, if you got to the point when you were pushing and your labor was obstructed and they could use a forceps. So there's a couple of different types of forceps that you can have. So you can have a forceps that's low down, and it's quite easy for them to get in, and like your forceps is like a little tongs, and so they get the tongs in there and then they help ease the baby out that way. But if the baby's further up the vaginal canal, it's going to be what's called a high forceps, and then depending on baby's position, sometimes it has to be rotated to bring it out. And so when that situation occurs, you can have that baby sitting there, and in that situation you can actually have a C-section successfully and fairly easily. And the risk of pelvic floor injury with a high forceps and rotation is way more than what it would be with a low forceps. So that's where you can then be in that position where you'd be like, okay, if I got in that situation, I would want to convert to a C-section over a forceps.
And it would be less traumatic versus the high forceps.
Exactly. And so that's where, if you've thought through all of those decisions, then you can go, okay, in that situation, that's what we would do. And sometimes there's no guarantees. Sometimes there won't be an anaesthetist test. There won't be a theater available. Like, there'll be all sorts of things that could happen. But at the end of the day, you at least know that you've done everything that you could. And you also know what could happen, so that then you're less likely to get birth trauma. So the research shows that birth trauma is largely psychological. It doesn't matter what kind of birth you have, as long as you feel supported, you feel like you're in control, and you feel like that you were able to make your own decisions, you're less likely to have birth trauma.
Yeah. So interesting.
It is. Is there anything else around the birthing experience, any top things that you just want women to know about that before we move on to post-birth?
Yeah, I think there's so much support out there that people don't know about. And, you know, you could get a doula if you don't have a support person, or you don't, your partner wouldn't feel confident advocating for you. And then a doula could be the person that asks those questions and reminds you. And they're not medical, but they've seen a lot of births. They've seen a lot of physiological births, so natural births, and a lot of obstetricians haven't. So in their training, an obstetrician only has to see, like, I think it's 5 to 10 natural births, and sometimes they don't even get that many. And they have to see like hundreds of, you know, other births.
So like cesareans and, and other interventions.
Exactly. Yeah. And so the difference between like an experienced doula who's seen, you know, 100 physiological births, it's going to be, you know, apples and oranges comparing them, isn't it?
I suppose as well, they've got that practice of pushing back against healthcare professionals and standing up and have that confidence to ask those questions, which sometimes you don't. And I mean, your partner, like, it would be, I imagine, a hugely, you know, anxiety inducing experience for them as well. Like, it's very emotionally charged. So having someone who's sort of, I guess, neutral.
Yeah, and we're just sort of taught to defer to the doctor or the medical professional, aren't we? Like, why would we question? Why would I question? What do I know?
Yes.
I suppose that's where that, knowledge is power, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. And there's an amazing obstetrician, Natalie Elphingston. I think I'm pronouncing that correctly. And I listened to a podcast by her, and that's where a lot of the stuff that I learned about that kind of obstetrician training and all of that came from. And she is now supporting a lot of women that are low risk and can have physiological births. And she's like, I had to learn a lot of stuff because I just didn't know that. And when I was a public obstetrician, there was just not the opportunity for me to see that.
And I suppose in the public system, they're normally brought in when there's a problem, right?
Yeah, so exactly. Their life.
They're not really there to, it's the midwives that do that other lower risk stuff.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah, that's right. So they're not even going to see those low risk physiological births most of the time.
So then the big events happened. Everyone's made it through to the other side, all fine. So what's the next? Like, I suppose maybe breaking it down, like, what's the first sort of like week to 4 weeks look like, or 6 weeks, I don't know, and then sort of 6 weeks to 3 month period?
Yeah, definitely. So I think rest.
I imagine there's differences. That's why I asked it that way.
Yes, definitely. Rest and recovery is so important and underrated. And I think in our culture, especially bounce back culture, and also just the culture of not really having a village and not really having the same kind of support as other cultures do. A lot of cultures have like a convalescence or rest period after birth. So they might have 30 days, some of them even have 6 weeks of where basically the mum just is in bed with the baby and everyone brings food to them, everyone does everything for them, because there has been so much stretch and so much that's gone on that, you know, if you want to reduce your risk of having prolapse and pelvic floor issues, you do need to rest and let everything tighten back up and heal before you then go and put pressure down onto the pelvic floor.
Is it good to start moving as soon as possible, or is it better to give yourself a week, or like to start walking gently, or like is there a best practice for that kind of thing? If you want to get out of the house, is that good to do? Is it better to lie in bed?
There is no best practice, unfortunately, but there is a lot of different guidelines that people have made up, and they say, you know, like 2 days in the bed, a week around the bed, and then 2 weeks in the house, and then, you know, 4 weeks in the same street, and then, you know, 6 weeks, you know. So there's lots of different acronyms or like kind of plans that people go with, but everyone's going to be different, and someone that's had a forceps is going to be completely different than someone that's had a normal vaginal delivery.
Yeah, or if you've had a C-section.
Yeah, exactly. And I think going by symptoms is going to be super important. So not pushing through any symptoms, obviously. And once you can walk comfortably, starting walking is great. But I think like limiting it to 5 minutes in the first week, and then 10 minutes in the second week, and then, you know, building up from there, so that you, even if you feel good, you're not putting too much pressure onto it.
But but it's okay to basically do it, base it on how you feel. Like if you feel good, or is it like, oh, don't like resist the urge. If you really want to go for a walk, you won't yet be ready on day four, or like, is it just okay to do it based on how you feel?
I think don't just go out and do it. That's my personal preference, just because I am more risk averse and would want to be preventing prolapse.
Yeah.
And you know, prolapse is the last thing that I would want. And some people, you know, don't have the same values as me in terms of that. But I want to get back to, you know, squatting 50 kilos in the gym. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, you know, it's one of those things where some people don't have those aims, and that's fine. And they can make their own decisions based on that. But in terms of if you have high level exercise goals, you want to play netball, you want to run. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you do have to think about that. The fact that if you get, you know, 20 or, you know, 10 minutes into a walk and you start to feel heavy and everything's dragging, how are you going to get back?
Yeah. But I suppose you don't want to be like totally sedentary either, because don't you have a risk of blood clots and all of those sorts of things as well? So I suppose finding a balance and making sure you're still getting up and going to get yourself a drink from the fridge or whatever.
Exactly. Yeah.
Rather and it's than just lying there all day.
Exactly.
Day.
Yeah. Regular, short. So, you know, instead of going to do a 10 minute walk, go and do like 4 or 5 5-minute walks, you know, like.
And resume the gentle squeezing, the pelvic floor exercises at what point?
Yeah. So you start pelvic floor exercises as soon as they're comfortable. So as soon as they're, you know, not causing any pain, and you get back into it from there. And, you know, usually you need a bit of guidance from your physio in how much you can do. And so most people, if they go and see a physio for a birth prep appointment, then they will give them that guidance depending on what their pelvic floor strength is at the end. Because if your pelvic floor strength is poorer at the end of your pregnancy, it's going to be harder. And then if your pelvic floor strength is better, it's going to be easier and you're going to be able to progress quicker.
Yeah. And then I guess in terms of a plan to resume your exercise, pre-pregnancy sort of level of activity, what does that look like?
Yeah, so from that 6 to 12 week mark, that's when you can start to resume exercise. In that first 6 weeks, you can do exercise lying down. And if you've got guidance and you know what you're doing, you can do like gentle movements, stretches, like lots of different exercises that you can do in those first 6 weeks. Mm-hmm. But you do have to make sure that they're safe and not going to cause prolapse. But then from 6 to 12 weeks, you can start to return to more normal exercise, and you can go by symptoms again, and you can obviously wear compression garments to support you. But then in terms of high impact exercise, the guidelines do recommend waiting until at least 3 months postpartum. But in that situation, I have had women that have gone back at say 10 weeks just because their pelvic floor is super strong, and you know, the type of delivery they had a C-section, and you know, they understood the risk and it was explained to them by me, and they chose to go back. So it's not hard and fast, but that is what the guidelines recommend, 3 to 6 months.
And before getting back into that high intensity exercise, because you might think you're ready, but you don't necessarily know. So is that what you would say to everyone who's, you know, given birth, whether by a C-section or vaginally, to go and see a pelvic floor physio before they resume any sort of intensive exercise.
Definitely, because I think that risk is so high, as I said, with the breastfeeding hormones as well. Mm-hmm. Like they're not going to go back, your hormones aren't going to go back to normal until either you finish breastfeeding or you're 6 to 12 months postpartum.
Right.
So
that laxity and things like that.
Exactly. Yeah. So that extra flexibility is going to be there and that risk is going to be there for at least 12 months, and it could be longer. Like if you're breastfeeding your baby 2 years, then you could be having that laxity for that period of time as well. So it's the highest risk period is the first year, but after that you're still going to be at risk. And if you don't have that pelvic floor strength supporting it, it's just those organs are going to basically be, you know, putting all of that pressure down.
Yeah. That kind of heaviness you talked about with walking, is that very normal for the first amount of time? Like at what point, when should that start to go away in theory if everything's returning back to normal as it should?
Yeah, it's definitely really common, and I hesitate to say it's normal because not everyone gets it. But in saying that, it can be very normal and can self-resolve in terms of it can go away, and it's not, doesn't always mean you've got prolapse. It can just mean that you have a bit of laxity in your pelvic floor that's meaning that things feel a bit heavier. So definitely not something to be super alarmed about and think, oh my God, I have prolapse, but definitely not something to ignore because it will turn into prolapse if you ignore it most of the time.
Yeah. Can we talk about, say someone's listening and they've had a really traumatic birth, they didn't know any of this stuff, they're trying to work out how to recover now. Do you work with people that are sort of out the other side, maybe they're a couple of years down the track and they're trying to run 10Ks, but they're having some issues, leakage, whatever it might be. What do you sort of recommend in that scenario?
Yeah, definitely. I think it's really important to stress that women do blame themselves. And I think it's really awful because it's most of the time, like I would say 100% of the time, it's not their fault. Mm. It's the fact is that they, you know, even if they didn't seek out the knowledge and they wish they did, like that's not your fault.
It should have been provided. Sometimes you don't know there's the knowledge to seek out either.
Yeah.
Like you don't know what you don't know.
Exactly. Yeah. It should have been provided to you, and it's 100% not your fault. And at the end of the day, like people can recover and can be managed really well. So I think definitely seeking out that pelvic floor physio, whether it's a year, whether it's 2 years, 3 years. I had a lady come to me the other day who was like, my birth was so traumatic that I just could not, I ignored that area for like 3 years, and now she's at that stage that she wants to work on it, and that's amazing, and we can help you then.
Yeah.
There's, you know, definitely no point of no return where you can't be helped. Like, you know, there's always going to be management strategies that we can do. And I think like really cool course that I did this weekend was about using pessaries, as I said, which is like that silicon medical support device that helps pelvic organ prolapse, but it can also help with leaking and incontinence. So it can help to support the vaginal walls and the bladder and the urethra to reduce those issues. So there's definitely
do you want to whip it out?
We'll show you. It's super cool.
We'll pop this on our social media.
It was a really good course. Got the logo on there. Melissa came over from New Zealand, which was amazing. And so this is a little cube. So the most common one.
Dice.
Yes. The most common one that they use is a ring. So the gynies fit a lot of these rings, and they basically go into the vagina, and then they help just support and lift. So you insert them kind of like a menstrual cup. So you do that like squeeze and insert, like similar to.
Can you
to,
feel it when it's in there?
No. So no, if it's,
how interesting.
If it's fitted right, you shouldn't be able to feel it, like a menstrual cup, you shouldn't be able to feel it. And so if it's not fitted right, then you are going to be able to feel it. But same with like the cube, it's kind of like a menstrual cup, you're going to squish it and then insert it. And you know, they look quite big, and these are bigger sizes, so there's a lot smaller sizes than this. I think this is like a 4, and you know, it goes down to obviously a 0. So you
how
can
long
have
do you keep it in?
So you can keep these in varying degrees. Like these ones you can leave in for like 3 months and not take them out and then just check them, but it just really depends. And then these ones, like often you have to take them out because you can't have sex with them in, obviously.
Say, impact sex.
Yeah, so you can have sex with these ones. That's why they're mostly fitted. And then there is obviously different ones as well. So this one's another type that can help support like different types of prolapse as well.
Dummy.
Yeah.
Interesting. How fascinating.
It is. And so they're really good if you can get a physio who knows how to fit them well and knows how to give you that extra support, because it can like change your life. In terms of some of the women on the course who had them fitted today and were like, wow, like amazing, like just lifts everything and gives you that feeling of like before you had prolapse or before you had any issues. So it's amazing.
I have one more question, and you may as well. Returning to sex after birth, love your take on it, but also in terms of if you've had a really traumatic birth, like I've got a friend who had a cesarean mm-hmm. but was still experiencing pain through penetration, like sex mm-hmm. afterwards, and she like was thinking it was linked to trauma. Like, is that common? Is mm-hmm. that any kind of, yeah, any shake?
Or even during pregnancy as well, yeah. because mm-hmm. a lot of people complain of like painful sex and things mm. during pregnancy too.
Yeah, definitely. And so most of the time during pregnancy, it's like the position of your cervix changes. And so that's where you're often getting that more deeper type pain. And it's going to be, yeah, when the penis is hitting the cervix that causes that pain. And then the other thing that can happen is just changes in the amount of discharge. So you can sometimes get vaginal dryness at mm-hmm. some points, and that can potentially cause the pain as well. And then after birth, even if you've had a cesarean, it's really common to get pain, and sometimes it is linked to psychological trauma, but a lot of the time it is linked to hormonal changes that you get early postpartum from breastfeeding. So those breastfeeding hormones dry everything up, makes everything more sensitive, and that definitely affects it. And there's lots of treatments that we can do for that as well, including like lubricants and improving the estrogen levels in the tissues and all of that kind of stuff. And, you know, definitely can be treated really well. Sometimes, you know, pushing through it and getting more and more pain with sex can then reinforce that and make it more of a nervous system response. Not that it's in your head, but your nervous system reacts to that fear of pain. And so that can take longer to untrain, but definitely something that we can work on and is super common. So many people have pain with sex even if they didn't have a vaginal delivery. Yeah.
Interesting.
Do you have any other questions, Teague?
I just have one more, because we'll probably have to wrap this up soon. Yes. We could just keep chatting all day. But I guess just around, like, I guess how frequently someone – so if someone wanted to engage a pelvic floor physio during their pregnancy, what would you recommend in terms of how often they see them, presuming they're sort of, I guess, low risk?
Yes.
So it's kind of hard, I suppose, at high risk. It's going to depend on the condition. But
yes,
low definitely. Risk, you know, what sort of frequency do you recommend? Because I know – obviously cost can be a big barrier for people, and when you're pregnant, a lot of people are thinking, gosh, everything's expensive, so it can be an extra cost. And I know there are some, is it like a chronic health care plan that you can get from your GP that gives you 5 subsidized sessions for any sort of allied health or like professionals? I'm assuming pelvic floor physios would fall in that category.
Yeah, definitely in that category. But for that, you do have to have that chronic condition. So you usually have to have had it for 3 months before the GPs.
Pregnancy doesn't count as a reason?
Yeah, because it's not a chronic medical condition. Right, so that sucks. But yes, it is a loophole. But a lot of GPs will do it if you have any other chronic condition, if you have asthma, if you have, you know,
diabetes some other, or something.
Yeah, like, diabetes, yeah, okay. like any chronic condition. So it just depends on the GP. Some of them are really strict on it and won't do it unless you have had a chronic condition with the specific condition you're seeking care for, but other people will do it as long as you have.
They'll find a reason to enable you to do it. Okay.
Exactly.
Get a good GP.
Yeah. Definitely.
I suppose they could just say there was weakness prevalent beforehand.
Yeah, exactly. That's right.
Depends like you how could honest they want to be.
That's right. You could just go in there and say to them, I've been leaking for the last 6 months, or I've leaked for however long, and you'd probably be eligible. But I think everyone should be able to get it. But in terms of how many sessions that we do, so most of the time I do a session in that second trimester. And if you're doing well, you're able to do your pelvic floor exercises, then I only do a session at birth prep, which is from 32 weeks onwards. Okay. So it's 2 sessions during pregnancy, sometimes another one before you give birth. If you're really wanting to avoid an induction, or you're wanting to really optimize baby's position, that kind of thing. So probably, you know, in that situation, if you want more sessions, great. But if you don't, you can self-manage all of that home. And then after birth, most of the time I will see people at 6 weeks. If they've had more complications, then I'll see them at 2 or 3 weeks, sometimes just for a phone appointment. And then you will then have another appointment at 12 weeks and or before you want to return to sport.
Right.
So you might be looking at, say, 5 to 6 appointments over the course. Okay. And then, you know, if you were to try to change your exercise routine, increase the intensity, then you'd want to come back later on. Or if you were to develop any symptoms later on, you'd want to come back. But most of the time you don't need to. You can self-manage and just get advice whenever you need it.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Well, thank you so much. It's so knowledgeable. It's like a wealth of knowledge.
I know, I want to keep asking questions. I love it. I hope this has been really, really insightful and educational for our listeners as well. Where can people find you? And just quickly recap also your courses and things like that are available. We know you're in Warrnambool. Some of our listeners might be, but not all of them. So how do they get help or access you, I suppose?
Yeah, definitely. So I'm the Lady Physio on Instagram and TikTok, which obviously we'll link. And I do have that free guide and an email list that I send out a monthly newsletter with lots of advice and things like that. And my course at the moment is obviously that's self-paced option that you can buy. So you can buy the course and just do it yourself with the monthly question and answers, or you can also buy a telehealth session so that I can assess your individual risk factors and we can go through and make that birth plan and things together. So that is part of the course that I have. And then over the next month or two, we're going to be bringing out those separate lessons. So if you just want to learn out, you know, perineal massage, you can just buy that lesson. Or if you just want to learn pelvic floor exercises, you can just buy that lesson. So there'll be a couple that I'll bring out like that, and a free masterclass and things too. So lots of things coming, exciting. Which is super exciting.
Yeah. So many resources. We'll keep us posted when they all sort of drop, and we'll be sure to share them. And like I said, we'll drop all your information in the show notes. But thank you to everyone for listening. And thank you so much, Chloe. Mm-hmm, and we will catch you in the next one.
Bye.
Bye.
The Brunch Files would like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the lands on which we live, meet, work and play, the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to their elders past, present and emerging, and of course any First Nations peoples who may be listening today.
This podcast is all about the adventures, stories and laughs of being a woman in her 30s. While we strive to entertain and share relatable experiences, please remember that our content is purely for fun and shouldn't be taken too seriously, and it's definitely not professional advice. Life is a wild ride and everyone's journey is unique. We believe that laughter is the best policy, and we're just here to spread some joy.